Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it is currently the 4th of May, 2012. And once again, we're joined on the line by Syrian Girl. So, Syrian Girl, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me here.
Well, as viewers and listeners might remember, we had you on the program a few weeks ago now, to talk about what's happening in Syria. But obviously, a lot has been happening since then. Why don't you bring people up to date about what's been happening?
Well, as we all suspected, the ceasefire was a complete failure. And both sides are, Russia is blaming the insurgency and NATO. Well, Lavrov said it was the countries who are funding the insurgency, and we all know who those are, for the break of the ceasefire. And this is because there's been a number of suicide bombings in Damascus area and in the Aleppo area, and in a city called Idlib. Also, the U.S. side is blaming the Syrian military and the Syrian government. But at the end of the day, if you look at whose interest it was for the ceasefire to break, it's clearly in the U.S. interest and in NATO's interest for the ceasefire to fail, so it can go back to the Security Council and further intervention, probably with sanctions, UN sanctions, which won't be as the sanctions are now, where the sanctions are basically optional. You know, a country can choose to apply sanctions this year or not. UN sanctions imply that the countries are bound by international law all across the world to sanction Syria. So I think that was the agenda behind putting up this ceasefire and then causing it to break. Now, the thing is, however, that yes, there have been a lot of bombings, but as a result, the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, said that these insurgent groups have to be squashed. So Syria's military has basically a green light from Russia to continue to push back these groups who were given cover by the ceasefire agreement, because as a result of the Syrian military pullback, now these insurgent groups have regrouped and regrown, and they're getting more brazen with their attacks. And yesterday, in the city of Aleppo, the Aleppo University was attacked, and 22 Syrian soldiers who came in were killed. So, you know, it's been a continuation of increasing momentum and bombings and sectarian violence. People are getting kidnapped for ransom, some by just criminals and some by criminals that are related to these insurgent groups, so that it will help fund the insurgency. So that's what's been happening recently.
And exactly as you indicate, I think the pieces are just falling into place exactly as we thought they would, with the media, of course, not reporting on such things as the Syrian troops being killed, but dwelling on civilian deaths, as reported by groups like Human Rights Watch, which came out with a document recently purporting to document the supposed crimes against humanity committed by the Syrian troops in Idlib. So, of course, we see all of this playing out pretty much as you say, as we thought it would. And you note Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, is, as always, trying to put the brakes on this process. But realistically, I don't know what we can expect to come from that. What do you really, I mean, do you think there's any way to derail this process as you've put it forward? Or do you think that that basically it's inevitable that the UN is going to be persuaded to act in that manner?
Well, you know, Russia could veto again. It would be difficult for them to do so, but they still could. Also, Syria is supposed to have some cards to play that it hasn't played yet. And the rumor is, and I can't prove that this is true, that Syria actually has captured foreign troops from France and I think maybe Britain. And they're using, and they're not actually saying anything about this, in order to use it for leverage. So that could come out, that in the UN Security Council that something like that could come out. I'm not sure if at the end of the day they will get their sanctions. I don't feel that they will. However, it's not the be-all and end-all for them. You know, they're still destabilizing Syria, and they're still creating this, you know, it's like a an equilibrium right now. But at the end of the day, Syria is the loser because people are dying on both sides, and the bystanders are dying, and the economy is getting more and more destroyed. So for Syria's enemies, it's still a good outcome for them. So something has to change. You know, something has to be drastically changed from the Syrian side. Otherwise, the end game would be a divided Syria.
Exactly right. I mean, I think it's obvious that the momentum is on the side of the people who are trying to destabilize the country right now, because all they have to do is maintain chaos and make sure that the deaths continue to happen. And that really is a type of win for them. So it raises the question, I mean, what can really be done to swing the momentum in the other direction? What could be done to re-stabilize a country like this?
Well, you know, the elections are planned for the 7th of May. And the U.S., I find it quite ironic, is quite upset that the elections are taking place, even though this supposed democracy that's supposed to happen. Also, you know, you have the opposition groups in Syria that are not linked to the insurgency. The insurgency call themselves the Free Syrian Army. That these opposition groups are internal, and they're against foreign intervention, and they're against the insurgency. But, you know, we're supposed to believe that this insurgency is pro-democracy, when in fact it itself has led to some of these internal opposition members to flee the country to Lebanon. So, you know, it's quite clear that these people are not for democracy, not for freedom of speech. They're after power, and they have a very strong sectarian element in them. So if the elections take place and, you know, there's a good turnout and there's international observers, then it would be very difficult politically for the U.S. to continue to support, you know, at least out in the open, to continue to support this sectarian element. What else? I'm not really sure. I feel, and you know, this is difficult for me to say, but I feel a way out for Syria is to go on the offensive and actually attack the countries that are sending in troops, money to destabilize Syria. So I think, you know, when it comes down to it, when Syria is cornered, it will probably attack either Israel or Turkey or Qatar. So that's one way out for Syria.
Well, it certainly would at least make sense from the perspective of, for example, if the U.S. was being attacked by some sort of insurgency that was forming and getting funds from Canada or something, we would expect the U.S. would be invading Canada overnight. There wouldn't be any debate about it. So one would see that would be just a reciprocation. But in the long run, I don't think that could possibly be an answer, because, of course, that would be exactly the type of provocation that the U.N. and the international community is waiting for to justify a crackdown down on Syria and to start the bombing.
Well, I don't think they would mind to see a Syria-Turkey war. They, you know, Turkey wouldn't be quite happy about it, but they would be pressured into it. So, you know, there was so much talk about a no-fly zone at the very beginning, and there was so much talk of, you know, a potential World War III. I still think that there is potential for that. However, now on reflection, I feel that it's been a form of brinkmanship, where what the U.S. is just, you know, and NATO makes it seem as though they are ready to start a world war. And it's playing a game of chicken. And Russia stepped up to this game and said, well, we are ready too. And then we just see escalation from both sides. And you wonder if there was any real intention for such a global war to happen. maybe it will become this way. Maybe at the beginning it wasn't. You know, it's hard to read. But because of this, and looking at Syria's air defense, Syria has the fifth largest air defense in the world, only surpassed by countries like Russia. The anti-air missiles are quite effective. So to have no-fly zone against Syria is quite ridiculous, because it would mean suicide for the planes that are sent in. And looking at NATO and the US's history, they always tend to attack countries that can't fight back and that are weak. So I don't actually think that was an option to begin with. I think that they made it seem that way to get these insurgencies and foreign elements inside Syria to continue to fight, in the hope that they're going to receive foreign backing. So looking at things from this way, you know, if Syria does ignite things and does start a war, it could be the, you know, someone's going to lose the war, someone's going to win the war, but some might argue that that's the whole agenda of the New World Order, just to start a global war. But if Syria, you know, if Syria is destroyed, then it might start anyway. It might end up that way anyway, because Syria is a very important piece of the puzzle for Russia, and to have at least one country in the Middle East that can threaten the missile defense treaty. So if war is going to start either way, it's better to start it on our terms, if you know what I mean.
I do understand that, but I always hesitate at that, because I don't think global war can possibly be an answer and in a good way. But I understand that it does seem that they're setting it up to happen anyway. Of course, always the people lose, and the military powers that be are unfortunately always going to win in those types of scenarios. So there has to be a way to find that we can, I guess, engineer some sort of situation where the so-called leaders can have their face-saving moment and de-escalate the situation. But again, it's difficult to imagine what that would look like. But let's step back and let's take a look at that bigger agenda that you talk about, because obviously Syria is just one piece of a much larger puzzle that's going on an international scale right now. And we bring in the specter of the New World Order, global government, global wars, these types of things. Where do you think the Syria situation finds itself in that bigger picture?
Well, you know, the reason to attack Syria, it's not just one reason, there's many reasons. And of course, you know, as I talked about last time, one of the reasons is Israel. And because Syria is in opposition to Israel, and has been for many, many, many decades. In fact, since the inception of Israel, Syria has been one of Israel's enemy number one, and they stand in the way of Israel's plan to grow. But also, you know, an attack on Syria is an attack on Russia, and it's also, because it's an attack on Iran, it's also a way on attack on China. And if you look at the what's happening right now with the war games in the South China Sea, you know, where Syria fits in, it's not just, you know, a country that, just another country on the list. You know, it's sitting in such a place that is between Asia and Europe. And there was talk of a pipeline going through Iran, Iraq, Syria, which would rival the pipeline that's already there, the TBC pipeline that's going through Israel. So all of this going around Syria, it's not just the internal politics in Syria that are determining what's happening. It's much more the external politics around Syria that is creating the situation inside Syria. And that's NATO and the US and Israel's rivalry with Russia, China, Iran, the emerging countries. I know they have a name, but I forgot about what it is. The BRICS countries, yeah. So that's what's happening right now. It's almost like the return of the Cold War in a way.
Yes, that has definitely been posited a number of times by a lot of different people. So let's examine that, because ultimately this is the type of thing that can demotivate a lot of people to be interested in this, because it seems like this thing that's overwhelming, that's something that the average person out there can't do anything about. This is something that's taking place at the UN Security Council and other things that we just watch unfold on the nightly news like some sort of horror movie. But what is the way that people can find to actually insert themselves into this to actually make a difference in the type of political calculus that's happening in the region?
Well, that's a very important question. I wish I had more to do. I'm not sure if what I do is making any effect, but the least that one can do is to speak out, to educate yourself, to educate others, and to speak out. The more people speak out, the more people seek alternate media and stop paying attention to mainstream media, the more that you can't be lied to. There's activist movements, one that is being led by Ken O'Keefe that is trying to create a trade between Palestine and the rest of the world. And that, I think, you know, something like that really has an effect on the ground. But I wish I could make better advice for people, but it's a question that I myself don't really have the answer to.
Well, I think we're all struggling with the answer, and I think it can only come in whatever way each of us is situated. And that's going to look very different for a Canadian living in Japan or whoever else out there might be listening to this conversation. Everyone's in their own situation. So I agree, though, that that one of the fundamental ways that we are led into war after war is through the lies. And I think that we're living in a fundamentally different paradigm than we were, say, a decade ago when the U.S. waltzed into Afghanistan, and the vast majority of the people in America and a lot of people around the world supported that action based on the lies about 9/11, for example. So I think we're in a different media paradigm, and I think it would be a lot harder to start that type of broad military intervention, barring some sort of cataclysmic event that that we often talk about that might be coming, for example, in the Strait of Hormuz. Along those lines, what do you think? Do you think that the public is at a point where they might be able to see through a transparent fraud like a false flag event?
Well, after the Iraq war, I would have said that because, you know, 2 years after Afghanistan, the people were totally against the Iraq war. But then what we saw in Libya was that the media was so powerful that, in fact, a lot of people were convinced that Libya was the right thing to do, even people that are staunchly on the left. So I think that the mainstream media is always trying to find new ways to fool people into thinking that it is a fair and balanced media. What they did with Al Jazeera, they set it up to be this opposition to the U.S. and pro-democracy, and then they turn around and they back something else up, so people don't know where to look. So while their media lies have become more sophisticated because people have become more educated, unfortunately, I think in some ways it is still being successful. And that's because people forget the axioms of politics. People just should remember that countries act in a way to gain power. That is number one thing you should think about. There's no question about humanitarianism. Aid is just a way of control. Every action that they do is to gain influence and to gain control. You can put ideology aside. All of that is just paint for the walls. If you start to think along those lines, it'd be very difficult for you to be convinced by the media of the positive thing of attacking countries.
That's exactly right. And that applies not just in international politics, but in internal politics as well. Of course, anything that helps to expand the government's control over its own people is also welcomed, which is exactly why false flag events work so well, because they get people to rally around the flag and support the people who secretly are working against their best interests. But again, I think there is a growing number of people who are aware of these tricks. And it's a question of if it's enough of a percentage to actually make a difference when the time comes. But again, playing out from here, I mean, we're still looking at what's happening in Syria. It's still unfolding. Egypt, again, is still undergoing its throes of revolution of one sort or another, with people now trying to get rid of the military dictatorship, but maybe just installing the Muslim Brotherhood. And happening in country after country, it's not a very pleasant picture in any in any field that we're looking at. So I guess once again, the question becomes, what do you think, A, is the likely short-term consequences of this, and B, in the long-term agenda, if we are looking at some sort of global conflict for the institution of some sort of global body or whatever, what do you think are the long-term likely consequences of this agenda?
I think that the consequence in the long term is going to be a lot of death, a lot of poverty, in order for this world, new world order, this new global government to take place, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So you can rest assured that such a world government is not going to have the people's best interests at heart. I think that, you know, the wars that are going to create this could have ramifications that will last for thousands of years if nuclear weapons are used. In the short term, I think that stability is going to... my view of what's going to happen is positive. I actually believe that stability is going to return to Syria. I believe that the foreign countries that are funding the insurgency are going to back off and going to realize that they're not actually going to gain anything by continuing to put money into this. And I just don't see, because so much time has passed by and Syria is still standing, I think we're going to come out of this as a whole country, a stronger country, and that this world war that they want to happen, maybe it will be delayed for a long time to come.
Well, we can only hope, and we can only do what we can to forestall the coming of that war. So any other points or any final thoughts you'd like to leave people with today?
I can't think of anything right now, I'm sorry.
Well, let me suggest to you, one of the courses of action that I recommend for people at all times and all points is to try to withdraw themselves from the systems of control as much as possible, because it seems to me that people feed into it by even what products they choose to purchase on a daily basis, which support the corporations, which support the government corporation nexus, which is the military industrial complex, etc., etc., and that the more that people can get off of the grid in whatever sense that might be, whether literally in terms of energy or whether in terms of food, growing things in their back garden, that's something that I always try to encourage people towards, is to try and get away from feeding that beast system with their dollars or yen or pesos or whatever it may be. What do you think about that as a type of strategy for people becoming involved in this?
I think that definitely, for, you know, it does help to boycott specific companies that have weapons contracts and that fund apartheid states such as Israel. I also think that it's not just what you buy, but who you work for. You should boycott, you know, working for certain companies. It's not okay to be part of something that is going to kill people, no matter how far you are down the line. Also, it's good to unplug your television, as I said before, and start educating people around you about what's happening. There was something I wanted to say, but now I forgot.
Well, when you remember, we can get you back on the program to talk about it. All right, well, let's leave it there for now, but tell people once again what your YouTube and Twitter accounts are so they can follow you.
Okay, so my YouTube account is Syrian Girl Partisan. And if you Google Syrian Girl, some of my videos might come up. And my Twitter account is just Partisan Girl. And I also have a Facebook, but all of the information is in those.
All right, excellent. Well, people can certainly find you, but don't use Google, use startpage.com. It's a little bit better for privacy. On that note, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.